Hello, and welcome to the More Like Canada edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm joined, as ever, by Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
And by Emily Peck of the Huffington Post.
Hello.
And the news of the week was, for those of you who are in another country or something, there was an election in America. We're going to talk about the consequences of the midterm elections, and the consequences are surprisingly far-reaching. We are going to talk about Medicaid expansion, cannabis, the way that the Democrats now control the House Financial Services Committee. We're going to talk about minimum wage. We're going to talk about Puerto Rico and banking and all manner of stuff. So we're going to try and work out how much we can squeeze in to this episode, because there's a lot to talk about. But let's start with Maxine Waters, who is basically the grandmother of the House of Representatives. She's been there for ever, I think. I mean, I think she dates back to like Abraham Lincoln's time, something like that. I did look this up. She has been on the House Financial Services Committee since 1991.
She knows how it works.
She knows how it works. She's a very, very experienced lawmaker. And she is now going to be the chair. After 28 years on this committee, she finally has the seniority to become the chair of the committee. And let's just say that she is not a sort of Tim Geithner-style technocratic Democrat. She has a bullhorn.
Although I would say that she rhetorically is very, very vocal, very, very, you know, far on the left in some ways. But in terms of actual policy, she's really been willing to work with other committee members, to work across the aisle. She, you know, worked with the Republicans in terms of making it easier for small companies to raise capital. So I think there's a little bit of a split of her kind of public persona and what she actually does in legislation.
She's big on small business. Mm-hmm. This is true. I think she was quite closely involved in the Jobs Act. Mm-hmm. She's in no way, shape, or form in favor of big banks. She's not going to be there's no way that the large, say, top five banks in the country are going to look at Maxine Waters and go, "That's exactly the person I want in charge of the House Financial Services Committee."
Yeah, I mean, she did an interview with Bloomberg this week after the election, and she talked about her priorities. She called out Deutsche Bank. I think she called them a bunch of money launderers.
She did. Yeah.
She
actually empirically true.
Yeah.
They were fined $600 and some million after being involved in a money laundering scheme in Russia, which amounted to like $10 billion. And one of the interesting things about the Financial Services Committee is that it is going perforce. It is going to become highly politicized because of this whole Russia thing.
And the other reason she called out Deutsche Bank was because I believe it was like one of the only banks to lend to our president, Donald Trump. And she mentioned that also as something she wanted to take a look at.
Deutsche Bank is definitely the lender of choice for the Trump organization and the Trump family.
Or the lender of last resort.
Tying that to money laundering kind of makes a little juicy little endeavor that Maxine Waters is setting up.
Right.
There.
Although I do think she was trying to make it very clear in that interview that that is not going to be her number one priority. Because
right.
I think there was a tendency of people to think like, oh, the only thing this committee now is going to be doing is issuing subpoenas. And I think she was making it clear like, no, we actually do care about things like affordable housing.
Yeah. She mentioned housing. She mentioned reining in Mulvaney at the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau because he is, you know, really been trying to run that agency into the ground. And it had been a successful.
I have a question. What can they really do? Like, what power do they really have? Because that agency is so independent.
What power does the committee have?
Yeah.
I mean, over the CFPB.
That's really the question overall for this committee and for Maxine Waters. What power is she really going to have? I mean, she can call these bankers in. She can hold hearings. But like,
She has subpoena power. And this is the thing which I think is this line that she has to walk, is that on the one hand, she does want to look, and the Democrats in general do want to look like they're being constructive and trying to actually do something positive rather than just throw rocks at the president. On the other hand, you know, given that the Republicans control the Senate, given that the Republicans control the White House, it's not like they can actually pass legislation.
Right.
So what's left, you know, is that if you're not going to pass legislation, you can hold all the hearings you like about trying to, you know, improve, you know, the state of public housing. But you're not going to get very far given the Republican control of the Senate and the White House. So instead, what you wind up falling back on almost inevitably is investigations of Trump and Trump-connected banks like Deutsche Bank.
Well, but there are other things.
Great.
But there are other things that are a little bit under the radar, but that are important in terms of extension of flood insurance, as well as making actually allowing the Exim Bank to function. Like, these are things that actually a lot of Republicans support. And if anything, Jed Hensarling, because he was so far on the right, wasn't playing ball on. So there are actually some real issues that she could work on.
So Jed Hensarling is the outgoing chair mm-hmm. of the Financial Services Committee. And he's, yeah, as you say, he's right wing, even by Republican House member standards, and just really doesn't want the government to do anything. Now that we have a Democratic majority and also just like not Jed Hensarling yes. running this committee, one of the things I think that we're going to see quite a bit of is a real emphasis on Puerto Rico and trying to make sure that the government continues to help out Puerto Rico, which, you know, after all, does not have any representation of its own in Congress. This is where the Democrats, especially in the House, feel like it's their job, you know, to stand up and start trying to help this island rebuild. It's already going to get $82 billion in federal aid, which is much more than people originally thought it would from the federal government. I think the federal government has quietly been rather more generous to mm-hmm. Puerto Rico than people thought it would be in the immediate wake of Hurricane Maria. But now that we have the Democrats really having this ability to start shouting and pushing, I think that, you know, the island could benefit even further.
How is the island right now in terms of its finances? I had read recently that it's doing better than believed.
Favorite chart is the benchmark Puerto Rico bond price.
Now, obviously, you know, my favorite too.
Puerto Rico defaulted on its bonds in 2016. So this is defaulted debt we're talking about. We're talking about debt which is paying zero interest. And all you're going to do is like eventually come to an agreement and hopefully end up getting some crumbs at the end. And that debt was trading at about 20 cents on the dollar immediately after the hurricane. It has now recovered to about 65 cents.
Well, because there was also just a contentious debt restructuring. I mean, there was an approval of the debt restructuring for, I think, about $5 billion of their debt at their development bank. And it's going to be like, I think, a 55% recovery value.
So the one of the weird things about Puerto Rico is that it has, you know, I think this is a technical term, like 80 gajillion different issuers.
Yes.
It's not like the government just issued all of the debt. There was the power company, the development bank, various, you know, government entities. And trying to do like, and as Anna says, it seems to be sort of being restructured on a very piecemeal basis. And they all have different liens and different priorities.
Right.
So, you know, you look at one bond and you try and say, well, you can draw a few conclusions from that. The main point is that it has gone up a lot. That after the hurricane, people were very pessimistic that there would be recovery. Now they're much more optimistic. And I think part of the reason for that, you know, and you can argue this, and I would, is that people are ultimately expecting that all of this aid that is coming into the island is going to wind up sort of at some point trickling into the revenues of the government, which will then have money to be able to pay bondholders. And you're like, well, yeah, but the idea is that it should stay on the island.
That's right. So interesting that this terrible, tragic hurricane actually is helping the country shore up its finances.
Well,
is
I mean,
there's probably still ultimately more harm.
Okay.
Well, I mean, a lot of harm, obviously. The bond price is now, let's just say it's back to pre-hurricane levels.
Okay.
It was about 70 cents pre-hurricane. So it's rough. It hasn't changed that much. But just sticking with the Financial Services Committee, the other thing which I do want to talk about besides Deutsche Bank, the other big bank which really should be worried, I think, is Wells Fargo.
Yeah. Oh, my God, Wells Fargo. Every day. every day it's something else with this bank. At Huffington Post, one of our reporters, Zach Carter, wrote an article. I think the title is, "Why Does Wells Fargo Even Exist Anymore?"
It's a good question because, well, a lot of banks are still, I mean, I saw a headline, you know, just a few minutes ago sort of talking about how UBS is now being sued for stuff it did in 2006 with residential mortgage bonds. Wells Fargo is being sued for stuff it did in 2016. Like, Wells Fargo is the one bank which just really just does not seem to have been able to get its act together. And it recently released a report saying, oops, did we say that, you know, 400 people lost their homes to foreclosure because we had no idea how to issue mortgages? It was actually, it was like 550, you know, they're clueless and incompetent, and no one has really been held accountable for this in terms of, like, you know, certainly no criminal prosecutions.
That's true. I mean, there was an executive shakeup after the account scandal, you know, where it was found that the bank was signing people up for bank accounts and credit cards and other things without their knowing about it, and they were fined. That was back when the CFPB was controlled by someone who actually cared about protecting consumers.
And fined Wells Fargo billions of dollars, yes, which would never happen under the current CFPB.
And in 2016, they actually replaced the CEO.
Well, and Yellen did kind of as a parting gift have put like a basic like a growth cap on Wells Fargo. So like that's not insignificant.
But it doesn't seem to have kept it.
Well, I think some of these things were also, I mean, my guess is this is like a legacy thing where they've had such a horrible culture that you're going to probably find that so many things happen. So my guess is it's going to take a, I mean, I'm not making this as an excuse, but I'm just saying it's probably going to take a little while before things really, really get cleaned up.
So we need this committee to come in and really like break it down.
And this is where the Financial Services Committee can really do something precisely because the CFPB is not going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, while the CFPB was still being run by Richard Cordray, you could more or less rely on him to be on top of this kind of thing and make sure that Wells Fargo is being held to account in some way. Mm-hmm. Now that the CFPB is like this huge lump which does nothing, it now falls to the Financial Services Committee to stand up and start doing these investigations precisely because the CFPB won't.
And I actually think you might be able to get some bipartisan support on that just because, like, pretty much everybody hates Wells Fargo at this point, except Jed Hanserling. But outside of that,
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
But there's more to these elections than just the Financial Services Committee and Maxine Waters. Emily, let's talk about the minimum wage.
Yes, voters voted to raise the minimum wage in three states, Arkansas, Missouri, and another one we'll look up for you that I didn't write down. I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry, everyone. And this is notable because in Missouri, for example, the Democrat running for Senator, Claire McCaskill, she lost, right? And you would think if people would vote for a minimum wage hike, they would also vote for a Democratic senator who would support a minimum wage hike. But there's this interesting split that's happening around the country where voters are deciding that they want these progressive policies like raising the minimum wage, or in a few states they voted to expand Medicaid. But they're not in those same states, red ones. They're not voting for the Democratic politicians, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think Democratic policies are often more popular than Democrats.
Yeah. And we see that with Obamacare, which has become much more popular now that Obama isn't president. And there can be this like decoupling of the person with the policy because the policies on their own are hard to argue with. I mean,
they're genuinely popular.
And
one of the interesting data points that we started seeing now is the job growth in Seattle and Washington State in the wake of their $15 an hour minimum wage, which has been incredibly strong. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually like the third strongest metro in the country in terms of job growth. And everyone who said that this $15 an hour minimum wage would prevent job creation, it's just like, well, it hasn't.
And you see, and you see the country's largest employers raising their wages there anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's, I think, almost a universal recognition that the minimum wage is ridiculously low. It's $7.25 an hour.
Yeah. I mean, I think when people are arguing
that's
against,
crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're talking about arguing against the minimum wage, I mean, I think this unfortunately can become like a little bit extreme on both sides. Whereas I think the Republicans often kind of have this like, what they learned in their freshman economics class of like, oh, well, if you increase the minimum wage, then employment always declines. And it's like, well, that's not actually true. However, I sometimes think on the left, there's also this idea that like you never have any negative consequences when you increase minimum wage. And that's also not true.
Well, I think empirically speaking, it's very, very hard to find any. Like we have now seen a bunch of minimum wage hikes in a bunch of cities and states. And yeah, I'm sure at some point, once you have like a couple of hundred of these, like you might be able to point to one and say, well, you know, employment went down or something. But so far, it hasn't happened.
Well, just globally, that's not entirely accurate if we're talking about minimum wages. A lot of it has to do with just how high you raise them. And what we're talking about in the U.S. has often been relatively modest gains or increases. And so usually that is the type of increase that doesn't have the type of really strong, like negative impact on the kind of lowest skilled workers, because that's usually what the issue is that it's usually the lowest skilled workers who, if you are going to have any unemployment issues, it's with them.
Yeah.
And it has,
as you say, like it has happened in developing countries.
No, we see this in developed countries as well, because often what happens is you have a minimum wage that can be a little bit too high that's tied with very strict labor laws. And that's not a good system.
But again, that's
not what this is.
Let's not start comparing the United States to that kind of minimum wage hike, because that is not the kind of minimum wage hike that anyone is proposing in the United States.
Right. I'm just trying to say that I think when you're talking about why anybody would not like a minimum wage, like that is usually the argument they're going to bring up. And I think it's important to understand the full argument.
Right. But again, the federal minimum wage in the United States is absurdly low, I think. It would be hard to find someone who would disagree with that statement.
There's literally only one place in America where the federal minimum wage is not absurdly low, and that's Puerto Rico.
What is the minimum wage in Puerto Rico?
Well, it's the same. It's the federal minimum wage is $7.25, but because the economy is so weak and wages are so low, that's the only place in America where you can conceivably make a case that raising the minimum wage might harm the economy. Outside Puerto Rico, there's nowhere.
And it's interesting. I just also want to note that the raising the minimum wage in Arkansas and Missouri will help women more than men. The majority of workers making minimum wage in those states are women. So these measures also have an added bonus benefit of helping close the gender wage gap.
So we have the ability, I guess, now that we have a Republican president, to start for Americans, especially in red states, to start embracing progressive policies, even if they're not embracing progressive candidates. This is a kind of like Nixon in China moment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And if you think about Trump's appeal, I was thinking to the working class. He did try and paint himself kind of as someone who supported progressive policies. Like he talked about raising the minimum wage at one point. He said he wasn't going to get rid of Medicare. He was supposed to be the working man. He kind of like conned people, I think, into thinking he supported some of these progressive policies, if you follow what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, he's never been much of a policy wonk.
Yeah. Right. But he put that vibe out there. So, but I think politically this is a problem. If Democrats have popular policies but unpopular politicians, that's...
Well, I think it's also just
that's a big roadblock.
This is not a controversial statement, but I think it just speaks to the fact that politics have become so red team, blue team that it's like, it doesn't matter if you support the policies. If the person's wearing the opposite jersey, you don't support them.
Shaking my head.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
And let's talk about cannabis, because one of the big pieces of news somehow on the day that everyone was trying to digest the election results was that the most anti-cannabis politician in America, Mr. Jeff Sessions, who was also in charge of all federal law enforcement when it came to marijuana, wound up getting fired. And so a bunch of marijuana stocks rose on that news. But then quietly at the same time, electorally, we had Missouri and Utah and Michigan all passing various levels of legalization. We're now up to 33 states which have some kind of legalization of marijuana, 10 of which now allow it for recreational use, and it's basically just completely legalized. And it's we have now become Canada. And so which is basically the dream of all progressives. It's like, oh, can you imagine if we became Canada? people don't realize just how kind of weirdly fucked up Canadian politics can be. But,
like, let's not go there right now. Yeah. Let's not
mention Doug Ford in this.
Yeah, it's getting rough for you.
But so what is going to happen with cannabis? My cards on the table, my expectation here is that there is basically zero chance of the federal law changing, that cannabis will remain illegal under federal law, that so long as it remains illegal under federal law, the fact that states allow it is not really going to allow it to expand that much, because even if your state allows it, what you're doing is still illegal. And if you're, running a cannabis company, you're still running a criminal enterprise, even if you are in California or Colorado or somewhere like that. But I do think that there is a decent chance that around the edges, things will become less forbidden, I guess. Like, for instance, the one thing which I think is a genuine possibility now is that somehow the federal government is going to allow banks, or make it, open the door to banks banking cannabis companies. One of the big problems with cannabis companies up until now is that they haven't been able to find a bank to, bank them.
But I guess I'm confused, because, yes, Sessions was very anti-marijuana, but it's not like Donald Trump is going to replace him with, an Eric Holder type attorney general. Like, why wouldn't DOJ, under whoever Trump appoints, be just as hostile to marijuana as it was under Sessions?
Well, maybe not in, the next 6 months, but it just seems to me, if we're looking, the next 5 years or so, it just seems like we're progressing in a direction that very few people outside of Jeff Sessions seem opposed to. It just doesn't seem to be a big issue on the right, is where it's actually a somewhat bigger issue on the left.
And there are, a lot of libertarian Republicans. You know that if you put Rand Paul in charge of DOJ, he'd legalize everything tomorrow.
Yeah, I also wouldn't have a government. So it's
I guess long term, it's inevitable, right, that marijuana will be legal in the United States. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that at all.
You're not saying that.
I'm definitely
that's what
not
I'm
saying
hearing.
That.
I kind of think that we're on that, go moving in that direction, especially now that you're having more companies kind of moving into that space. Other drinks companies, kind of, because it does seem like it's the type of product that eventually will become part of the kind of alcohol space.
Well, exactly. And I think that what we have seen with the reaction to the opioid crisis is a realization that you can't just let companies drive policy, that when you have companies like Purdue basically driving government policy on addictive drugs and potentially harmful drugs, very bad things can happen. Bad things have happened with opioids. Bad things have happened with alcohol. Bad things have happened with tobacco. The government is cracking down on vaping. This is one of the other big pieces of news this week, is that there's going to be this massive crackdown on companies like Juul and flavored tobacco and vaping, because, you know, there's, I think, this increasing understanding at the government level that what these companies are doing, even if it's legal, can be incredibly harmful and that it needs to be regulated. And I think there's going to be a lot of hesitation to allow companies to start driving this, you know, cannabis bus.
On the other side, you're also now going to have more lobbying power to try to legalize it. When you if you have larger companies who are now moving into this space, that's the other thing I think that they could also be pushing on the side of, yes, there's going to obviously be regulation of this product in the same way there's regulation of alcohol, but there does seem like there'll be more money behind legalizing it.
It seems like if the federal government sticks to its stand that marijuana is illegal and then in the states it gradually becomes legal piecemeal, it seems like you run into the same problems with marijuana that you do with the other drugs, whereas it's not really regulated and people don't really understand the consequences of legalization, maybe.
Well, I think with the other drugs, I think, you know, there's virtually no regulation at the federal level. So, like, say alcohol is quite effectively regulated at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like guns, you know, it changes wildly from state to state, but there's almost nothing that the feds do.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that the federal government is going to want to be more involved in that. Like, the idea that the federal government is going to do almost nothing on the cannabis front and just leave everything up to individual states, I can't see it happening.
Or, well, you could also get, depending, it'll be really interesting to see what happens, especially like post 2020, if hopefully we get a someone other than Donald Trump in there. You could also get a federal government that just doesn't, even if they don't themselves legalize it, they just don't actively prosecute anything. Like, they just kind of allow the states to develop their own industries and then eventually it becomes legal.
But I wasn't understanding about what Felix was saying, because he was saying there's going to be a regulations around marijuana because we've learned our lesson because of opioids. But like, it seems like that's not the direction we're going in. It seems like we're going in a direction of either benign neglect or like, you know, anti-marijuana.
So the benign neglect thing works on a kind of criminal basis in terms of, do you prosecute people for selling and using cannabis? It does not work on a corporate basis, that you're not going to have banks doing something criminal, even if they know they're not going to be prosecuted. You're not going to have large companies doing something criminal, even if there's a nod and a wink from the federal government that, hey, we're not going to prosecute this. Like, no general counsel would ever sign off on that. So you're going to need the federal government to do something more than just nothing, you know.
Which is a lot to ask.
It really is.
And plus, at some point, you know, there will be a big debate at the federal level about the harmful effects of marijuana and the way it can cause psychosis and violence and various things like that. And we are going to have data.
Really? Psychosis and violence?
Psychosis and violence, yes.
Really?
Yes, have you? Really.
Okay, because that came as a surprise to me.
And it hasn't been reported widely, and we are going to have data from states as they start legalizing it and as marijuana usage starts becoming much more measured and you can see where it's going up and how much it's going up. We are going to have actual data on, you know, the rates of violent crime and stuff like that.
Well,
and
shouldn't
see
we know about that before it's legalized?
Yeah,
like,
that would be nice.
Just really
one
upsets
would think,
me.
Yeah.
I feel upset about that.
It also seems like you should probably have like drinking or like driving while high laws as well. You know, like there's a lot of things that work into this.
Yeah, it actually seems like this is, I mean, I know I'm supposed to be progressive and I work at HuffPost and we like legalized marijuana, but it does seem like we're going about this in kind of a willy-nilly,
it hasn't
dumb
really been
way.
Thought through.
Yes. It's like everyone's high that's working on it.
And so the question is, like, is there a chance that the government or the federal government is going to be like grown up about this and put together a very coherent, thought through policy on marijuana?
No.
Even the Canadians haven't done that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the chances of that are slim.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
And since this is the big political edition of Slate Money, and since the Iran sanctions went into force this week, Anna, this really isn't an electoral thing. This was basically just imposed by the White House, and I don't think that the elections made any difference one way or the other. But what on earth is going to happen now? Because like this huge Iran deal, which was put together so painstakingly by the Obama administration, is that now completely dead?
It's a little bit of a mix, which in itself is kind of a bad thing because uncertainty is very bad for economies, especially economies that are already having trouble like Iran's. Because what ended up happening is that the U.S. did issue a lot of waivers to, I think, the eight different countries that are still going to be able to buy Iranian crude for like a 6-month period. And then those waivers can be extended. So right now, I still think like half of the daily supply is still going to be sold. But it's still very, very bad for Iran because we're going to have this system where it's like, first of all, like every 6 months, what's going to happen? And already you have a situation in Iran where the economy didn't benefit quite as much as people thought it was going to after sanctions were removed. And so now you have, you know, massive inflation, you have massive unemployment, you have this tremendous uncertainty, which makes it impossible for businesses to operate. And at the same time, the Trump administration obviously thinks, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to bring them back to the table and they're going to renegotiate. They're absolutely not going to do that because they understand this was a unilateral measure. All of the other countries that were involved in the deal still want the deal to be in effect. So I think they're probably going to say, if we can just, I mean, I don't know this obviously 100%, but it seems like they have very little incentive to try to get a new deal. It's more like, well, let's wait this out till a more reasonable leader gets in.
We did see everyone's favorite Belgian nonprofit, Swift,
yes,
basically banned all money transfers in and out of Iran. That happened immediately.
Yeah, and this is actually the bigger deal in some sense. And this was actually a bit of an issue when the last time sanctions were removed, but they still were issued with the dollar system. Because if you can't access the dollar system, it just massively increases your trade and finance costs. So when you already have a country that is having massive financial problems, putting that into the mix, it just means that like nothing good is going to happen in that
but
country.
SWIFT
until
is more
change.
Than just dollars. Even if you want to pay Iran in euros, you basically have to do that over SWIFT.
Yes, that is true. But that's also part of just Iran not having access to the dollar system, which essentially all global trade goes through.
And I read that the sanctions are actually benefiting Russia now. Maybe you can explain more about this. They're going to pick up whatever oil trade that Iran lost.
Yeah, I mean, like right now in terms of who's actually like accounting for the lost production, a lot of that's going to be the Saudis are already, they're just pumping more oil essentially. In terms of effect on oil price, it's essentially had no effect on oil price because first of all, everything had already been priced in. And then actually oil prices have came down significantly this month, which had absolutely nothing to do with Iran. It had far more to do with inventories in the U.S. and the fact that we had just had a bit of a bubble in the summer caused by a number of things. So, yes, it is true to a certain extent that a number of other oil producing countries could slightly benefit from this. But I don't think that's going to be an enormous issue.
And the one detail in the piece about Russia was that because you can't use dollars, Russia wants to use some kind of bartering system to work with countries
sanctions? we will get a bunch of Iranian oil and we'll give you a bunch of like Matryoshka dolls or something.
Sounded great. Sound like a really good plan.
Excellent plan. Yeah.
But is there a mechanism in place to prevent Iranian oil from simply just getting sold to Russia and then Russia selling it on to the rest of the world?
I'm sure that there are safeguards to a certain extent in place, but also usually when you have sanctions, there are ways to evade sanctions. And I'm sure some of this oil will still find its way to market.
And there's no doubt that Russia is going to continue to buy Iranian oil, right? I mean, they have no reason to abide by an American sanctions.
Well, China's going to continue to buy Russian, or China's going to continue to buy Iranian oil. I mean, this is going to be very, very bad for Iran. However, that doesn't mean that Iranian oil still is not going to make its way out.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's have a numbers round. Because, you know, there were lots of numbers around this week. Emily, you're looking very puzzled.
Oh, I was just trying to think of what number I wanted to use, but I got it. I'm good.
Okay, what number do you want to use?
Oh, 7,376.
Okay.
That is the number of acres of land owned by Apple. And that is a drastic increase from 2011 when it owned 584 acres of land. There was a piece in the Financial Times that it's a little bit of a mystery what they're going to do with all this acreage. And this isn't counting their office space.
Was this just like, you know, a bit of backwoods, like trees and farms? Or what is this?
I don't know. It's the is the same size as Cupertino, apparently.
But is this urban?
No, I think they think it's like going to be data centers, solar farms, things like that.
My number is 271 million. I feel like Anna's going to like this one. 271 million Chinese yuan, actually, which is about $39 million of debt, which was issued by Chuying Agro Pastoral Group Company, which ran into debt servicing issues. And so the holders of this debt have agreed, instead of taking their payment in Chinese yuan, like you would expect, they have now agreed instead to take their payment in ham.
Speaking of bartering.
Wow, that's so much ham.
I imagine just like debt restructuring. I'm like, okay. Well, we're going to lower your coupon by 2%, but we're going to give you a 10-pound ham.
And these are very high-end
hams. You get a ham and you get a ham.
There are a lot of hams being sent out to bondholders, and they're very high-end, expensive hams. People are going to be having a good, like, you know,
it sounds like
New Year.
A delicious deal.
Oh, man, I can't compete with that.
Well, had the helmets last week, I feel like I'm still living off that.
Didn't help LSU. My number is actually sports-related again, is $50,000. I was actually listening to the Hang Up and Listen Slate podcast, and they were talking about the WNBA, and that's actually the starting salary for WNBA players, and their median salary is like $75,000. And like, I get it that the WNBA is going to be paid significantly less than the NBA because the NBA is massively profitable, the WNBA is not, all these things, totally get this. But like, the WNBA makes less than the D-League, that's like the men's like minor league, like that those players make, that like someone who just came out of high school, basically. And like, I get it. These are very different things.
I don't get it. You keep on saying you get it.
Wait, the WNBA players make less money than D-League male players?
So there's this woman, there's this WNBA star who's featured in a Wealth Simple ad who is like so unbelievably overqualified it's ridiculous. And there's this really quite compelling ad which shows her progression compared to a more or less roughly but not quite as qualified male player. And his starting rookie package was $4 million and hers was $40,000.
Oh, come on.
It's literally 1%.
Right. And it's like, I guess the only reason I do say that, like, because these are just such different things. That's why I almost feel like it's tough to compare the NBA and the WNBA because they are just such incredibly different things. However, it does seem like you're never going to be able to keep the talent also in the U.S. when they can go overseas and make twice as much. So women players can make twice as much if they go overseas.
Well, that's still only $80,000.
Right. But the problem is just that, unfortunately, women's basketball just still isn't, especially like the WNBA, like literally isn't profitable. So when you're comparing that to something that's incredibly profitable, it's going to be tough.
But these things are not set in stone. You know, there are reasons why the NBA is profitable and why you know, and it's basically because of deals around television rights. And
I do think there are definitely ways that they could.
Television can start showing more WNBA. You know, I mean, people, they love women's tennis. They can get into women's basketball.
It's true. They really do love women's tennis. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why they couldn't love women's basketball.
Oh, great.
And you're not going to have a star if you pay everyone $40,000
a
year.
Yeah.
So it's like you're starving this thing. It's never going to get off the ground. And then you can. Good number.
One of my favorite data, like, you know, little anecdotes from that is that one of the things that male basketball stars do to just because they're male basketball stars is when they finish a game, they'll give their jersey to one of the fans, you know, some kid. They'll be like, here, have my jersey. The women can't do that because they only have two jerseys for the entire season.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
First of all, can we all just pause and reflect of how much Felix seems to know about this one
I am
sport?
Impressed about the knowledge about WNBA.
Not to mention, like, I'm now flashing back to stories about women's club football, like soccer, mm-hmm. in the United mm-hmm. States,
yeah.
where they wind up playing on like crappy baseball fields,
mm-hmm.
and it just it's not good. It's not good. We need more equality in sports, as in everywhere else. Talking of which, we're going to have a fun Slate Plus segment about the vitally important question of, can you expense a strip club on your corporate credit card? That's coming up in Slate Plus. And for everyone who subscribes to Slate Plus, thank you very much for doing that. For everyone else, that is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. Keep the emails coming, slatemoney@slate.com. Thanks to Max Jacobs for producing. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.